It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll take Turkey 101 with the host of Wisconsin Foodie.
First, in an open letter this week, a group of scientists and other scholars argue that gray wolves in the western Great Lakes region should not yet be removed from the federal endangered species list. The species has been on and off that list in recent years thanks to court decisions and other legal challenges.
This letter comes as a rebuttal to 26 other scientists who sent a letter last week to U.S. Interior Secretary Sally Jewell. They argue that the western Great Lakes gray wolf population has rebounded enough to justify wolves losing their endangered status. So why are we seeing such a split among experts?
John Vucetich is one of the scientists in favor of federal protections. He lent his voice to this week's open letter. He's a wildlife ecologist and associate professor in the School of Forest Resources and Environmental Science at Michigan Technological University. He joins us now to talk more about why he thinks wolves should stay on the list. John, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, yes, it's great to be here. Thanks.
So, John, we have two groups of scientists and experts in the field arguing two very different things. You say keep these wolves on the endangered list. First of all, why? Make the case for that.
Yeah, sure. You know, the question about whether wolves should be delisted is complicated. It has many parts. There are legal dimensions, ecological aspects, social aspects as well. But what's most important is you can't even approach this question about delisting wolves unless you first ask the question, what's the purpose of the Endangered Species Act? And on that point, there's controversy, and I think that's what's at the root of this controversy as well. Some people think the Endangered Species Act, its purpose is limited to making sure that species don't go extinct, and that's it. However, other folks think that the Endangered Species Act is premised on this idea that we've done wrong by a number of species that live in our country. We've done wrong by them by restricting their ranges greatly, destroying their habitats, this sort of thing. And that to do right by these species, according to the Endangered Species Act, we ought to recover these species to maybe something like most of the places that they used to live. Now, that view of the Endangered Species Act seems to be supported by most legal scholars. It's been supported by about a dozen court cases. It's consistent with the congressional intent at the time of the ESA being signed into law. And if you appreciate that take on the Endangered Species Act and then realize that wolves in the lower 48 occupy only about 10% of their former range, this leads one, I think, to the answer that they probably still belong having the status of endangered.
Now, in that narrower interpretation of the Endangered Species Act you mentioned, it seems like, as you mentioned, the goal is non-extinction, keeping the species around, presumably enough biodiversity, genetic diversity within that species so they can stick around. Are we, even with that narrow view, are we at that point? Do we have enough of these gray wolves in the western Great Lakes region to meet that narrower standard?
Oh, I think more or less, yes. If the goal is just to make sure they don't disappear from the lower 48, if that's it, then probably there's a case to be made that they don't need to be endangered.
What would you like to see, though, beyond that, to not just keep them from going extinct, but to go somewhere along that path toward restoring them to what they once were?
Well, you know, my greatest wish really is to first of all for American citizens to understand this really is not a question just about wolves. This is a question about the Endangered Species Act. There's approximately 1,000 species protected by the Endangered Species Act, and we've reached this juncture, this point in history, really, where we as the American people are confronted with this question that we don't quite know what an endangered species is. Obviously, legal scholars have their views. We've heard this week from the views from two scientists. But I think the American people need to kind of wrestle with this question and kind of understand what is an endangered species. And that's my greatest wish, is that we come to understand that. And when we come to an understanding of that, then we live by it and abide by it and try to do right by species according to that view.
Talking to John Vucetich from Michigan Tech, he's making the case in favor of keeping federal protections under the Endangered Species Act for the gray wolves in the western Great Lakes region. In this other letter, people are worried about the integrity, this is a quote, the integrity and effectiveness of the Endangered Species Act. They're making the case basically that if we don't take animals off the Endangered Species Act, if we take a long time to do that, it might make policymakers, states, and others more reluctant to put other species on in the first place. Do you worry about that impact?
Well, maybe two thoughts. One is that many species that are on the Endangered Species Act right now are not there because states decided that they wanted them to be there, but they were put there because somebody had to sue to have them put on there. And so that would be one thought. The other thing is that I am absolutely aware of the fact that there are threats against the Endangered Species Act from people who are not keen about it. But I don't think that the right way to fend off those threats is by ceding some of the things that those folks are interested in anyways.
What would need to change in order for you to support ultimately delisting the great wolf? What would you like to see in terms of numbers, habitat, range, protection?
Well, you know, I think the most important thing is to kind of understand, again, that, you know, wolves only occupy about 10% of their former range throughout the United States. And so what I think is what's really needed before we start delisting wolves from any particular region is to ask that question, what is our federal government's plan for the entire country? I think really that question comes first.
And what should that plan be?
Well, that's the responsibility, of course, of the Fish and Wildlife Service to come up with a plan that makes good sense. And the plan only has to be consistent with the law. And the law is complicated on this point, so I'm absolutely paraphrasing, but just for the sake of clarity, the law suggests, to many people anyways, that to be recovered, the species has to occupy most of its habitat. So if we just take the literal definition of most, you know, just 50% or more. And so from 50% to 100% is a huge range, and the federal government may well have that entire latitude or range. It's really kind of up to them to figure that out. And whatever is appropriate, it's certainly clear that 10% is not right. That's so far from the mark. And so I'm happy to see kind of, you know, reasonable proposals from the federal government as to what would be appropriate.
A concern that might arise from the public is, okay, if we're bringing them back into their old range, some of that range might now be residential areas or farmland, or hunters might be concerned that wolves are competing with them to get deer in a region. Mixed use, zero-sum game, people might say. How would you address those concerns from the public?
Yeah, a couple of concerns. One concern is that, you know, it wasn't all that long ago when we first started recovery efforts for wolves. And, you know, for example, the recovery team leader for the Great Lakes thought that the Upper Peninsula of Michigan could only have three packs in the whole state because they thought that Tasmosis could be supported. And clearly that's not the case. We have so many more wolves than that now in Michigan. And so the point of that little story is that both wolves and people can surprise us. And surprise us in the sense of getting along better than we sometimes presuppose. That would be my first concern. My second concern along these lines is that if we decided as a people that, you know, we just don't want to live with wolves in all of these places, you know, I would, as a citizen, I guess I would have to accede to that if that's what we all decided as a group. But then we can't just say, okay, we'll delist the species and call that a success. I think we have to say, well, we've chosen to not recover it. And if we choose to not recover it, that's, you know, maybe that's okay, but then we shouldn't declare it a success, which is what happens when you remove something from the endangered species list.
I know it's a twisting and winding process. Are you confident, based on where things are now, that the gray wolves in the region will stay on the endangered species list?
Oh, you know, I've worked with wolf issues long enough to know that what's around the corner is often a surprise. And so, you know, I think this is an important ongoing issue, and I'm not good at predicting what's going to happen next on that account.
We'll leave it there. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You bet. Thanks so much.
That's John Vucetich. He's one of the scientists who signed on to an open letter this week calling for continued federal protections of gray wolves in the western Great Lakes region. He's a wildlife ecologist and associate professor in the School of Forest Resources and Environmental Science at Michigan Technological University. Tomorrow is Turkey Day, the day when most of America sits down to some kind of turkey dinner with all the trimmings, but there's a lot about turkeys we may overlook on Thanksgiving Day.
Kyle Cherik is the host of Wisconsin Foodie, and he's here now to give us a Turkey 101. Kyle, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
Back at you. So how did we end up eating turkey, of all things, on Thanksgiving Day?
It's a really interesting story, and it came by way of the conquistadors in the 1600s. Landing on southern Mexico, and though they were looking for gold, they brought back so many other things that we're now used to that we just take it, you know, we assume are part of the American diet, potatoes and tomatoes and things like that. But the turkey that they encountered was already domesticated, and so they brought it back. It spread to Portugal and then on into what was called the Levant, which was essentially the greater Middle East. It was a French term. And but as early as 1581, England set up the Levant Trading Company to monopolize on the Ottoman Empire and the spices and all the good stuff coming out of there. And by the time, not at Plymouth Rock, but by the time that we get to the early 1700s in America, the turkey had basically become the bird of celebration and large feasts because it was this great domesticated bird that had more yield in meat than pretty much anything else northern Europe had.
And didn't you say that these early turkeys were kind of giant?
Well, the ones, so that's, yeah, the ones that the pilgrims would have encountered in and around Plymouth Rock, the eastern turkey, which is still somewhat of a pure breed, those are Rambo turkeys. Those are 4 feet tall, 30 pounds on average. They look more like descendants from dinosaurs and Jurassic World than they do the kind of turkey that, you know, we think of. Although it's interesting, you know, the average weight of a turkey in 1960 was 16 pounds. The average weight of a turkey that we're going to have on our dining room tables tomorrow is now 30 pounds because of all of the breeding and all of the genetic specificity. It would not be, I don't know how to say it, it would not be wrong to basically call them pathologically obese, the birds that we are now eating on Thanksgiving.
Is there a big taste differential, Kyle, as far as you know?
A big taste differential? Well, I can't speak to it. I mean, this is going back, I don't know how many hundreds of years, right, to the 16th century. I hunt and I adore wild turkey, and it has a very different flavor to it. Not anything like the whiskey, also of the same name. But, you know, a store-bought turkey, I mean, we kind of run the gamut here. So there's that great Saturday Evening Post picture of the turkey dinner. And that, just as Dickens kind of codified Christmas for us, that picture really told America what Thanksgiving should look like and what that celebration was all about. And there's that massive bird in the middle of the table. So the ones that are bred are hybrids of a couple of different breeds, and they're bred to have a huge breast meat and predominantly white meat because that's what the American consumer cared for. Personally, I like the dark, so there's always enough for me. But I would say there is a difference between that and one that is raised on a CSA or a Wisconsin or Midwestern farm. And that's one of the other things. When turkeys are called cage-free, they're all cage-free. I mean, to be cage-free, they only have to be out of doors, and there's some wiggle room there for 51% of the time.
Is there such a thing as a free-range turkey? We hear that word used a lot with chicken.
Oh, sure, definitely. And a free range is a turkey that was never kept indoors predominantly. So when you pack a bunch of turkeys in together, they get very aggressive. And one of the things that the industry will do, and this is sort of the dark side of our Thanksgiving, but they'll microwave off that first toe so they can still walk, but they really start to peck at each other. They're kept in large houses, and they're kept in low light because that also drops down the aggression label. A free-range turkey, you know, I talked to a farmer last week in preparation for this. She's got 40 turkey that come and go on her farm. They eat the grains that she feeds them, the worms that are in the ground, the bugs, that sort of thing. And she had just slaughtered and froze all of them. You know, she said, we had no problem with avian flu because we don't use antibiotics, and we feed our turkeys essentially like they would be in the wild, though their life is so good here that they don't fly away.
Wow.
You know,
so
yeah.
That's a real free-range turkey. Voluntary turkey almost. Right, so you talked about some of the different flavor profiles when you look at maybe a more commercially bred turkey versus one that's maybe more like the ones you described who choose to stay there. What is the difference in taste?
I think it's more rich. I think that there's a sense of iron in a good way, not like a you know, cut of liver, which I'm not a big fan of, but a sense of iron that's in their blood and that's in the meat. A free-range turkey, and there's so many different breeds, but a free-range turkey in general is going to taste more like dark meat that the American palate would know and less like that super clean antibiotics, never let anything else have a choice but grow that big white breast, you know, kind of flavor.
Now, you were mentioning earlier how turkeys had become the bird of celebration for some from early settlers from Europe. Mm-hmm. And to me, that sounds like a tall order. I feel like turkeys are really hard to cook. It's hard to know when they're done. It's hard to make it so it's not dried out. And some parts are completely desiccated and other parts are edible. So, I mean, Imagine the cooking tools. They didn't have the pop-up meat thermometers back then. So how do you do this thing right?
I think the paradigm is also important. The way that a turkey would have been cooked through much of the celebration would have probably been on a spit, right? Or would have been in a large stone, you know, the same oven that would have baked bread and things like that. So slow and low like barbecue. The skin would have been crispy, but everything else would have been delicious. You know, for us, I mean, we just go with the classic Cook's Illustrated recipe. Peter Kimball is my spirit animal when it comes to cooking things like that. And, you know, he and his folks have spent more time and energy researching it than NASA did on getting someone to the moon. So we kind of abide by that. The one thing that we don't do is put the stuffing inside the bird, because you're either bound to have a dried out bird or undone stuffing, in which case, if you use eggs in the stuffing, you know, then your friend Sam Manila is coming to the dinner as well. It's really hard to get the interior of a bird that is now, that's the other thing, these enormous birds, it's hard to heat up the stuffing on the inside. When they were 16 pounds or smaller, it wasn't that hard, you know, something more like a goose. So we've sort of gotten away within the tradition of the stuffing inside the bird. What we like to do is actually cook it halfway and then cut it into large pieces, lay those over the stuffing, put it back in the oven, and then all that yummy turkey juice goodness seeps down into the stuffing, makes the dried cherries that we use taste delicious. And, you know, we miss the Norman Rockwell moment, but we're eating this. We're not taking pictures.
Well, happy turkey eating, Kyle.
Thank you. You too.
Kyle Cherik is the host of Wisconsin Foodie.
We're just a couple days away from Black Friday, considered by many to be the biggest shopping day of the holiday season. Many stores feature Black Friday specials and deals. In recent years, the day has become such a big deal, it bleeds into Thanksgiving. Some stores have after-dinner doorbuster deals or even open all day tomorrow.
But some retailers are saying no. Outdoor store REI announced earlier this fall that they'll be closed on Black Friday. Some stores are putting out statements about their decision to stay closed on Thanksgiving as well.
John Talbot is with us now to talk about Black Friday and holiday shopping ahead of the Super Bowl of shopping. He's the Associate Director of the Center for Education and Research in Retailing at Indiana University. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. How are you doing?
Good. So when did Black Friday become such a huge shopping holiday in the first place?
Well, Black Friday's been around for a number of years. And, you know, historically, it was the day when they said that retailers actually went into the black, that was the day they started to make money, because obviously so much of a retailer's expenses are fixed in terms of a store. So Black Friday was the day where they finally got through and paid the rent for the whole year, essentially, and went into the black. So it's been, you know, around for longer than I can remember, and I honestly can't give you the exact date, but probably 75, 100 years. But, of course, quite different today than it was then.
Right, so it's changed a lot, and now we've got Cyber Monday, and we have some stores closing. Is Black Friday, is it still deserving of its reputation as the Super Bowl of shopping days?
I think it is the Super Bowl. It may be today is more like the NCAA 14 playoff, where we have, it begins, and there's an ongoing series of events as opposed to the single emphasis on one day that we saw previously. I mean, retailers are finding ways to, you know, extend the holiday and essentially spread it out, mostly through the use of their e-commerce situations or their websites.
Now, let's talk about the internet and Black Friday. And for a while, we were talking about, you know, the real live stores, you know, brick and mortar versus the internet. That is changing now. I mean, Amazon has a real bookstore in the works, I guess, but Walmart is making a big push to have their online entity be a big factor on Black Friday.
Yeah, to me, I think it's the term, kind of the battle between brick and mortar and e-commerce has ended, and I've said to a couple people this holiday season, and I've heard it from others, that we should just think of it as commerce again. It's right back around together. And most of the major traditional big brick-and-mortar retailers, like the ones you just mentioned, Macy's, Kohl's, any of the larger department stores, their single biggest location, if you will, it's not necessarily a physical store, but their biggest business is done now through their website. So they're as invested as a company like Amazon in ensuring that they have success in commerce that takes place through a digital medium as opposed to a physical one. But retail's back around united again, and I think, you know, especially with what you said about Amazon opening a store, we're going to move to an environment where I think there'll be a blend of physical and digital for almost any retailer, and the question is the ratio.
Should we be looking at Black Friday as a kind of litmus test for how well the economy is doing, or is it sort of too niche a situation for that?
I'm not sure that we should look just at Black Friday. I think the overall performance during the holiday shopping season is still a very important indicator of the overall health of the economy and the confidence that individuals have. With Black Friday and the fact that there's so many other mechanisms for customers to acquire the goods they desire during this time period, I think it could be possible that Black Friday might be down in sales, say, relative to a year ago, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the quarter itself will underperform. As a matter of fact, most sources expect this to be a pretty strong holiday shopping period in the United States.
Talking about Black Friday and the related holiday shopping season with John Talbot at Indiana University. One of the things that prompted this discussion, John, is it seemed like for a long time there's a movement, you know, advertising, we're opening earlier on Black Friday and earlier. And now, oh yeah, we're opening on Thanksgiving Day. Now we're seeing stores publicly announcing, hey, we're staying closed on Thanksgiving, or even, as we mentioned, REI saying we're not even opening on Black Friday. So what's leading to some stores publicly moving in the other direction?
Well, I think last year, as you and I think we may have even spoken last year, Rob, but I remember, you know, it seemed as if, you know, if we were having this discussion 3 years ago that we expected retailers to start on Wednesday, for example, and just shop all the way through Thanksgiving. And a lot of people were upset that people were not able to be with their families in their homes. And I think that equilibrium has been found, and Walmart really figured out maybe a year ago, over the last couple years, that moving back any further really doesn't positively affect the business. And then as far as stores like REI, REI is uniquely positioned to abandon Black Friday because they are they're owned by their customers and by their employees. They're a cooperative. I think if Macy's announced that they were closing on Black Friday, they would wake up Monday with their share price down 15%.
Do you think there's any sort of blowback if stores do this, but then also sort of engage in being closed on Friday in a way that's self-congratulatory, going, look at us, we're closed. Other stores have tried to do this. Does that backfire?
Yeah, I like REI's approach. REI, to me, is being authentic about it because they are a retailer whose primary, you know, the goods they sell are related to activities outdoors. And I think that it aligns nicely with who they are. And I think, you know, they're probably not really walking away from a huge amount of business anyway because they're not noted as sort of a Black Friday deal location. I must have that pup tent on Friday. So I think that for them, it made sense. It's aligned with probably who they are from a value standpoint within the brand themselves. But, yeah, I agree with you. I don't think everybody jumping on the bandwagon and say, look how good I am. Consumers are not going to believe that.
And REI, kind of a luxury item or a specialty item store, your more general stores, Walmarts and Targets and department stores and things like that. Could they afford to lose that kind of business that they might bring in on a Black Friday or even a Thanksgiving?
They absolutely cannot. I mean, I think that, you know, the reality is that Black Friday for a long time had gotten so promotional, and the retailers have gotten, I think, more, well, they've always been intelligent, but I think more sophisticated in their approach to Black Friday, where they go out and seek value for their customers, you know, at the beginning of the year. You know, they've probably been working on Black Friday for 12 months, planning the items that they're going to have, and they've probably worked with their manufacturers to purchase those at prices that are valuable not only for the consumer but also that allow them to make money. And so, you know, I think Black Friday probably is a better day for them than maybe it has been historically from a profitability standpoint. But they can, you know, it's maybe 1.5-2% of the month in November. And if they walked away from that, they wouldn't make that back up on Saturday and Sunday, which would be the last day of the month, which means November for them would be a disaster and Wall Street wouldn't like it very well.
Do you think that we've reached sort of a peak when it comes to this closure on Black Friday? Is it a trendy thing that's going to continue and maybe we'll see more stores hopping on? Or do you think this is maybe the peak that we're going to get?
Do you mean in terms of people abandoning Black Friday?
Right, shutting down and letting their employees stay home.
I think that it's going to be very specific related to the retailer. I think for some retailers, it probably makes sense. I think for perhaps small businesses, you know, located in a downtown square, I think that they've lost the Black Friday the battle for a long time because that's not what people look for. And I like the idea of, you know, local Saturday that's been invented. Although it's an invented notion, I think it is something that's a good idea for local merchants to sort of try to identify what makes them different and why people should save some of their spending, the money they intend to spend during holiday, and use it at the, you know, to buy the unique products that some of these local establishments have.
Yeah, I wanted to ask about Small Business Saturday. Is that something that you think is actually making a difference, or is this still just a drop in the bucket compared to the big stores and Black Friday?
Small in terms of total value, but I would hope that it's important for smaller retailers who are responsible for a lot of the innovation that we see out there and interesting new brands. I live in Bloomington, Indiana, and we have a number of unique, interesting retailers down on our town square and in kind of the downtown shopping area. And they do bring something different from the big guys. And I think being engaged and finding a way to get the word out, and people do want to kind of support local businesses and people's livelihoods depend on that. And a lot of times it's somebody that you know and you walk in and shake hands with them. And I think we sort of have a vested interest in wanting those folks to do well. And so I hope that it's successful. It seems like a little bit of branding around it and uniting themselves together and can maybe help to pull people to that downtown location in more suburban or even urban shopping areas.
John, any predictions for what the hot ticket items are going to be this year for Black Friday and beyond?
Well, we do a poll in conjunction with a company called collegefashionista.com that has young women blogging at campuses all over the United States and the world, and they told me that boots are it this year.
Boots
or booties.
Boots
so,
or booties.
And apparel, I think, will also do well, at least with this population. These are young women, and apparel is always their most important item. But we don't have an iPhone in the mix this year that's going to, you know, take some spending away from other items, and the iWatch is, I think, something that people have already purchased if they're going to. So I think, you know, apparel, accessories, footwear, the three areas where a lot of the spending will take place.
Great. Well, John, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you, guys. I hope that you guys have a nice holiday season.
That was John Talbot, Associate Director of the Center for Education and Research in Retailing at Indiana University. He was with us to talk about Black Friday shopping. We just heard from retail expert John Talbot about Black Friday and holiday shopping trends for this coming year.
And now we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your plans for Black Friday shopping, hitting the stores or avoiding them at all costs. Do you think stores should open on Thanksgiving? Would you go to them, or do you think they should be closed to let staffers and customers just enjoy their Thanksgiving holiday? What do you think about the news that REI and other stores are deciding to stay closed on Black Friday itself? And are you one of the people shifting from going to actual reality-type stores to buying stuff, buying your presents online? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our callers now. Heather is first in Stevens Point. Heather, hi.
Hi.
What will you be doing?
Thanks for taking my call. I work on Friday, so I won't be shopping. But my comment was that people get very upset that retail workers have to work on Thanksgiving or on Black Friday, but nobody really comments that healthcare workers and hospital employees and other types of workers are working on these days, and no one gets in a big uproar about that.
Okay, interesting. Thank you, Heather.
Heather, thanks a lot. And I had just on Facebook seen a back and forth, I think between two of my cousins it was, one making exactly Heather's case, one saying, well, but those are essential workers, of course, they have to work, so why have to come in on a holiday for a non-essential job? So this is a live debate, I think, going on around the internet on social media. Heather, thanks so much for your call. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234. We've got Lori on the line next in Green Bay. Lori, hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good. What do you think, Lori?
I think that stores should stay closed on Thanksgiving and that should be a day for families and that they could open at like 4 o'clock in the morning on Friday like they used to. It makes it more exciting.
So exciting to you, Lori? I mean, were you somebody who would show up early at a store on Black Friday?
Oh, definitely. I used to do it all the time.
Used to, but not anymore.
No. No, I've kind of steered clear of it lately because I'm, kind of boycotting the Thanksgiving Day thing. I think, that should be a family holiday.
All right. Well, Lori, thank you so much for sharing that with us. We are talking about Black Friday and holiday shopping, and we want to know how you do it if you're going to be out there on Black Friday or even tomorrow hitting the stores. Small Business Saturday, are you a business owner participating or somebody who's looking to shop at local small businesses on Saturday? Are you more a Cyber Monday kind of person? call in, or are you working, by the way, on the holidays, Thanksgiving or Black Friday itself? Are you bracing yourself for it? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And as always, of course, you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And if you're not going to be doing any of those things,
right,
retail involved, what will you be doing with that extra Friday if you're not working and you're opting not to go to the stores? It's interesting to me. I used to be one of those shoppers on Black Friday.
Really?
I would look forward to it before it happened. And then when I actually went shopping and I was crushed with people, I thought, why was this something I wanted to do so much again? And there was an excitement to it. I'll give you that. But these days I opt more maybe for a walk in the woods.
My biggest mistake was going grocery shopping on the evening before Thanksgiving.
Oh, I've
one
done that
time.
Many times.
I found the last parking spot. Yeah, it was an exercise in patience. I'll say that. Back to our callers now. Rich is on the line in Hale's Corners. Rich, hi there.
Hi there.
What do you want to tell us about?
I think the holiday, all stores should be shut down so people can remember what the holiday is really about. I mean, people are calling and saying, they're fighting over people who work at hospitals and things like that. I'm sure those people, if they had families in the hospital, they wouldn't dispute it. We're talking lives over presents. It's ridiculous. I mean, if everybody would just not shop, the places wouldn't be able to open.
All right, Rich, thanks a lot for sharing your thoughts on that at 800-642-1234.
And we go next to Heather. Heather joins us in Madison. Hi, Heather.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure.
I just wanted to say I will not be shopping on Friday. I think Black Friday is awful in so many levels. Just the consumerism of the holidays and what that's become. It's not what the holidays are about. Thanksgiving is a time to be with family. And so is Christmas. I mean, when people are thinking about running out to get presents, it just doesn't mean as much as spending time with family, giving gifts that count. And I hope more people start thinking about Giving Tuesday, which is, it's after Cyber Monday, after Black Friday. And Giving Tuesday is a day to give back to your community, to donate to local nonprofits, where you can really make a difference and spread love in a very different way.
Great. Well, thank you for that, Heather. Appreciate you calling.
Then we'll go next to Lauren on the line in Viroqua. Lauren, hi.
Hi, guys. I just wanted to call and say, yeah, I used to work in retail, and one of the reasons I got out of retail was because it got to be such a maddening time of year, and I am now a nurse working in Viroqua. So I am still working the holiday season. Mm-hmm. In fact, I'm working tomorrow, and as I speak to you, I got one hand on the phone and one hand making some turkey gravy. So we do a big potluck tomorrow, and it's going to be, you know, coworkers and family of coworkers.
Lauren,
so, yeah.
I got to ask, I worked in a mall a couple years during holiday season, and I am now allergic to pretty much every Christmas carol you can throw at me. Did that drive you nuts, too?
Yes, because they're on right now. It's taken me maybe 3 or 4 years to kind of unsensitize myself from that, and I was shopping for groceries the other day just bopping to Jingle Bells, so it's been a complete turnaround.
Wow, good for you. It's I'm still a couple decades from hearing the ninth different version of Silver Bells in a one-week span, and I still haven't got it back. Lauren, thanks so much for your call.
Appreciate that, and we're going to go next to Paul joining us in Trigo. Paul, hi.
Hi. I think it's important to support small businesses, local small businesses. Every dollar that you spend in a small local business stays in your community, circulates an average of, I think, 6 times before it departs. I'd rather support my friends and neighbors and their entrepreneurial efforts. Oftentimes we lament the homogeneity of the marketplace, and why not support something that's unique in the entrepreneurial spirit? So that's my comment.
All right. Well, appreciate that, Paul.
Thanks for that call. Go next to Marcus on the line in Green Bay. Marcus, hi.
Hi. Yeah, you're talking about shopping on Black Friday. I think, you know, I don't know anything about that, but there's enough time in the day to do both, as long as I think do it, the shopping before, or do whatever you need to do before, and have the get-together afterwards. That way there's not a deadline. And my thing I'm going to tomorrow, it's the same every year, is that Thanksgiving takes place, and then the hosts have tomorrow's a 3 o'clock thing, so everything, bam, it ends at 3 o'clock. So it's kind of like hanging over, and then, you know, everybody, bam, we're out of there. So I think just do it beforehand and then get together afterwards, and everybody relaxes. And you know, that's not even, you know, part of the Thanksgiving day. It's already been taken care of.
And, Marcus, after that 3 o'clock deadline, you're watching the Packer game?
Yeah, that's what I don't understand. I don't know what's going on. I'm confused. I guess I'll travel home and miss part of the game, and that's not a real big deal. But yeah,
okay.
It's nice to see the kickoff. Thanks.
All right, Marcus. So a little planning. He says you can work that shopping in on Thanksgiving if you really gotta.
And we've got a comment here from Gina on Facebook who says, I won't be shopping on Thanksgiving ever and on Black Friday, only if I've taken complete leave of my senses. Shopping for sport, not a chance. So there's someone who will resolutely not be out there in the throngs.
Still time to share your thoughts over at the Central Time Facebook page. Let us know if you'll be shopping, how you'll be shopping, whether you'll be shopping at all over this holiday weekend, Thanksgiving Thursday, Black Friday, Small Business Saturday, Monday,
Cyber Monday,
and
right.
Giving Tuesday. Let us know what you're doing on any of that on the Central Time Facebook page. Love
and
to see your thoughts there.
And we should give a shout out to our stalwarts here at Wisconsin Public Radio who will be working on Thanksgiving and on Black Friday. I guess that's us on Black Friday.
We'll be here on Black Friday.
But our beloved technical director, Michelle Good, will be here manning the station on Thanksgiving Day. Joy Cardine will be in as well. But there will also be pie, so there's a bright side.